Welcome to the Composer Studio Podcast.
I'm Anna Linville.
And I'm Tarek Ghirardella. Our guest today is composer Paul Morovic. Paul's music has earned many distinctions, including the 2004 Pulitzer Prize in Music, the Rome Prize Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, three awards from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Rockefeller Foundation. A graduate of Harvard College and Columbia University, he has taught at Columbia, Dartmouth, and Hunter College, and currently holds a special position of university professor at Adelphi University on Long Island. Morovic's music has been recorded by many, many orchestras, ensembles, and soloists. Paul, I wanted to thank you so much for coming on. It's an honor for both of us to have you on the show. And it's a real great pleasure to meet you.
You're very kind.
I understand you're from Buffalo originally.
Yes, I can't deny it.
Does that make you a Buffalo Bills fan?
No, not necessarily. I'm a Buffalo fan. You know, it's certainly a great city. One aspect of Buffalo I like is Buffalo. The nicest people in the world live in Buffalo.
I can believe it.
It's an amazing thing. It's such a great city.
You have a really established career and a championed career as a composer. Was there any influence from growing up in Buffalo that did it play a part in music for you? And how did you become a composer?
Yes. And the most formative experience of my very young life is being a boy chorister. I started out as a boy. It's a little complicated. We moved around a bit. I was born in Buffalo. Then I moved to Princeton. We moved to Princeton, and then we moved back to Buffalo. And so by the time I was 12, I was the head chorister of the choir of men and boys at St. Paul's Cathedral in Buffalo, which is a great honor and a great experience. A very important part of my apprenticeship as being a boy chorister, which really began in Princeton a few years earlier.
Princeton's a great community for music as well. I was there for about a year.
Oh, yeah.
And just amazing the kinds of things that come through there.
It's a great place to be a kid.
It's really beautiful.
An enlightened place, yeah.
It is lovely. It's magic.
When you were young, singing in the chorus, were there any pieces that stood out to you that for whatever reason stuck in your head and you still remember to this day?
Well, for example, we did the St. John Passion, you know, a Bach. This was a good choir. It is a good choir. I mean, we did, you know, the Christmas parts of the Messiah every year. And I was the lead soloist on that as a treble. And the most formative aspect of my training there was getting to know the music of the Tudor composers, most notably William Byrd, Thomas Weeks, then Dowland, et cetera, et cetera. That whole tradition, the whole tradition of British choral music, all the way up to the present. And in the 20th century, it was Benjamin Britten. So that was a very important aspect of my dawning musical awareness.
Do you still sing?
Not formally, but I sing, I'm writing oratorios and operas and so on. So I sing as I work.
No church choirs for you.
No, not at the moment. So
maybe someday.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we want to go ahead and jump right into the first piece that we'll listen to today. That's your violin concerto. And we're going to listen to the second movement. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole piece, it's one single movement with implied movements, two more, I guess you could say, moderate or quicker movements around the slow movement. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, it's four movements.
Four movements.
It's it's violin concerto. It's your standard issue violin concerto. No, it's more
standard issue.
Standard issue.
In the album notes, you mentioned Samuel Barber and his violin concerto, and I was curious if, in some way, did Samuel Barber stick in the back of your mind as you were composing it?
Well, I love his effortless lyricism. I mean, that's principally what I take from his work. He's a very great composer. His harmonic language speaks to me. He speaks my language generally. I mean, I really respond to his work, and particularly in his concerto.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to it now. This is Violin Concerto, the second movement, performed by Maria Bachmann, violin, with the Symphony in C Orchestra, conducted by Rosin Milanov.
Thank you.
That was Paul Moravec's Violin Concerto, performed by Maria Bachmann. Paul, is there an intended narrative or programmatic aspect to your Violin Concerto?
Everything I write has a kind of narrative, however abstract, an emotional, psychological narrative that in some cases I can't really articulate in words. If I could, then I wouldn't have to write the piece in a way, but the music speaks the ineffable in a way, mm-hmm. or what I can't express otherwise. But everything I write, whether it's actually programmatic or if it's abstract music, I mean, some pieces are song cycles or operas or oratorios, and those are clearly programmatic, and there's a narrative, mm-hmm. Et cetera, and I'm tracking the emotional trajectory of a piece very, very closely, you know, bit by bit, moment by moment. But in the case of this piece, there's an arc to it emotionally that I can't really describe. The only way I can describe it is just play the piece, listen to it. That's how it's revealed to you.
So do you start when you sit down to write music, do you start with an emotion, an idea? I mean, this, especially a piece like this that is just purely abstract, mm-hmm. and you know, doesn't seem to have a narrative in, per se. How does this kind of music come to you, and how do you sit down to write something like this?
Well, every piece is different. Again, if you're writing a piece that involves words, I begin with the words. Mm-hmm. That's always the first impetus in writing a piece. And then I follow the words, and they take me into the world of music, and then begins the actual sounding notes, you know, and mm-hmm. imagining what it's all going to sound like. I tend to work on the piano generally, once I find my way into a piece with words and beginning with the making the music, it's mm-hmm. the same process then as writing an abstract piece like a piano sonata or a string quartet or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that is, I begin with a musical idea. I begin with very often with a motive. And then I build from there. And I tend to think of my work as something that sort of evolves organically out of a seed. And I think of writing the compositional process, there's sort of two ways of approaching it. One is from the outside in, and the other is from the inside out. So there are composers, for example, that will begin with the overall structure, the skeleton, and they know, you know, how long it's going to be. They know the whole structure of the piece, and then they work inward to work out the details inside. I tend to do the opposite. I begin with the seed of an idea, and then I see where it takes me. And yes, I'll have some idea, especially if the commission says it needs to be half an hour long, whatever. Okay, I have some sense of the time scale and so on. But beyond that, very often I will follow where the notes take me, where the music takes me. And the greatest joy of being a composer is at least in the process of composing, the greatest joy comes when you get to the stage in the piece, and it very often in my experience is sort of at the halfway point is what it's going to turn out to be, where the music starts to tell you what it wants to be. And then I'm sort of along for the ride. I'm listening to what the piece is telling me. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's a kind of weird supernatural experience. And so that the piece itself becomes my partner in mm-hmm. writing the piece. It's my, you know, it's an interesting process.
In 2004, you won the Pulitzer for music.
Right.
That is a huge achievement. And I think, you know, the ambition of so many composers in the world. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone really describe for me, what was it like to win the Pulitzer, you know, to get to that point. And then how did it change your life, both personally and as a composer?
Well, I was thrilled. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a computer error at first, you know, but actually the way I found out about this, my wife and I were in Italy. We were staying in a town called Taormina. And this is in 04. So it's before the internet really came of age. I mean, it was there, but you really had to log on, you know, you really had to find, you know, a terminal somewhere where, and it was really before cell phones were really prevalent, you know. So, and there certainly weren't any smartphones. So I didn't actually know for many hours until it was announced, 3 o'clock in New York on a particular day in April. And I didn't find out for many hours later. And I found out sort of by accident when I called somebody and they said, you know, what do you think about the prize? And I said, what prize? And they said, you don't know, you know, you won the Pulitzer Prize, you know? And I had to check online because I thought it was, sure enough, you know, anyways, this wouldn't happen today. Now you would know immediately. Mm. But I was thrilled. And more importantly, prizes are useless unless you use them. You know, the whole point of a prize is that it's something that opens doors, that, or any honor really, is that opens doors, raises visibility, and provides some opportunities that I might not have had previous to that. And that's certainly the case. Certainly in my case, that's what happened. It opened a lot of doors. And it changed my life pretty much immediately and materially. You know, because I didn't have to worry about getting commissions so much anymore because they started to come. And I wasn't unknown in the music world before that, but the Pulitzer certainly puts you on a different plane pretty much immediately. So
the piece you won the Pulitzer for, Tempest Fantasy, it's a very personal piece for you, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
If you'd like to, you know, kind of tell the story of how this piece came about and what your feeling of connection to the character of Prospero is,
yeah,
from Shakespeare's Tempest.
Well, Prospero is a very interesting character, and The Tempest, Shakespeare's play, is my favorite play of Shakespeare's, and it's my favorite play, really, of all, and it had been for many years, In 1995, I suffered a very severe episode of clinical depression and needed electroshock treatments. And so, which, by the way, I think saved my life. Mm-hmm. So I don't, in any event. And my wife and I, as we got on with things and, you know, and pressed on with our lives, we happened to see a production of The Tempest with Patrick Stewart, you know, who's most famous for being Jean-Luc Picard in, you know, the Star Trek show. He played Prospero. It was a public theater production in New York, and I thought it was terrific, and I loved it, and I got into the world of The Tempest and Prospero and so on. In any event, I wrote a piece for Maria Bachmann, you know, who we just heard playing the second movement of my violin concerto. I wrote a piece for her called Aureole Fantasy, where I imagined myself in the role of Prospero and she as Aureole. Now, the relationship there is that Prospero is a magician who cannot actually realize his own magic. In other words, he can think up the spells, but he cannot do it himself. He needs Ariel to actually execute it. So this struck me as a kind of relationship between a composer and a performer. I can't play the violin. I can write the music, but I need someone like, a brilliant violinist like Maria Bachmann to realize it. And so that's what that's the relationship. I'm Prospero, mm-hmm. She's Aureole. So I call it Aureole Fantasy. She liked the piece and said, why don't you make a whole Tempest suite out of it? You know, and so I called it Tempest Fantasy. I asked her, I wrote it for the Trio Solisti, which is a piano trio. And I asked her, you know, I'd like to write something for David Krakauer, the genius clarinetist. And so we asked David to be involved. And he said, sure. So I made it into a quartet, and that's Tempest Fantasy. But along the way, I identified with Prospero because he is really a very melancholy character who's at the beginning of the play, he's in exile, he's in disgrace, his life is basically over. And but he prevails in the end through the power of his imagination. And so I identified with that aspect of his character, and indeed his whole character. And so that's the Tempest Fantasy.
This is Paul Moravec's Tempest Fantasy, Ariel, performed by Trio Solisti with David Krakauer, Maria Bachmann, John Klebanoff, and Alexis Pia Gerloch.
Thank you.
That was Tempest Fantasy. The movement was Ariel, composed by our guest today, Paul Morovic. That was recorded on Arabesque Records, featuring Trio Celisti and David Krakauer, and of course the music of our guest today as well. Paul, what a vibrant, exciting movement. I mean, just full of energy and such virtuosic playing. When I first looked and listened to the piece and I looked at the ensemble, one thing that struck me right away was the quartet for the end of time. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there's any association. I realize now that it was a group that already existed and you already had written a part for Maria. But I'm wondering if at any point it struck you as well. Hey, this is the same ensemble as Quartet for the End of Time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly aware of that piece. It's a very great piece. And but it didn't particularly influence what I did in my piece for this same ensemble of, mm-hmm. of instruments. And it puzzles me that there's not more music written for this ensemble, that is a piano trio plus clarinet, because with just four players, you actually have a miniature orchestra. It's it covers all the bases. It's very, very flexible, especially if you double the clarinetist on bass clarinet, as I do. It opens up a whole range of possibilities. It's a very efficient, tiny little orchestra in miniature, mm-hmm. and very powerful. I mean, there's a lot you can do with it. So again, it puzzles me that more composers don't compose for this ensemble.
Well, maybe they will after they hear this. We have a lot of music students listen to our show.
Oh, okay, great.
Composition students. So I think that it's it might be interesting to them.
Well,
to
I'll
think
put
about
on my
it.
Professor hat and say, "Get cracking! Let's go." More to be
great.
Done.
Yeah. Speaking of which. What role does teaching and sharing your knowledge and your experience in music play in your life?
A huge part of it. It's very important. I'm very fortunate to be university professor at Adelphi University on Long Island. And I've been here for something like 25 years now. And I consider teaching and being an artist as complementary activities. And in fact, in a certain sense, they are indissolubly linked. They're one and the same. The difference is that as a teacher, very often you teach by precept. That is, you abstract ideas out and you articulate them and you project them in lessons and lectures and in private lessons, teaching, and so on. Whereas as a composer, as an artist, generally, one leads by example. The teaching is in the work itself, the example of the work. It doesn't need to be articulated you don't need to talk about it and so on. But in both cases, the teacher and the artist are both on the same page in that they're conveying values of some kind. If I might use the word, there's a kind of moral aspect to teaching and a moral aspect to being an artist. In the case of an artist, it's the moral aspect is simply doing the best work you possibly can. I can't remember the name of the writer, but somebody, I love this quotation. He's a novelist, and I think it's John Gardner. He said, "Bad art is basically creepy." I love that expression. I know what he means. You feel kind of, if it's cheap, I won't use names, but
yeah.
I won't be more specific than that. But you know it when you read it or hear it or see it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Bad art, you go, ew. There's something basically kind of creepy about it. And so the reverse side of that is that I believe that there's a kind of doing the best you can with what you have is a kind of moral act in and of itself. Mm-hmm.
How do you manage the, you know, being a composer is kind of a solitary activity. And then you have to be this person who is gregarious and is there for your students. You know, when I can imagine it must be sometimes a challenge to work in those, in both of those worlds, especially if you're working on a project at the same time while you're teaching.
Again, these are complementary activities in the best sense that there's the, well, in the sense that there's a contrast between the two. Yes. I mean, being a composer is essentially solitary. And I don't mind that. I like, I like working on my own. I also like, I am, as you say, gregarious. I mean, I like to, talk to people and hang out with people and so on. And, so one needs both, you know.
Yeah.
So one is a relief from the other. One is a, is a contrast to the other. And
yeah.
that's, I think that's a perfectly healthy way to get on with things, you know.
Let's move on to the next piece, The Blizzard Voices. Now, the movement of the movement from this piece we're going to hear is Blizzard Bore Down. And so Blizzard Voices, there's a whole story and narrative behind this. And I, you know, if you don't mind, if you could just give us a quick review of how this came to be, what it's all about, before we go ahead and listen to the piece.
Sure. This is an oratorio that I wrote for Opera Omaha. It premiered in 2008, and it is a dramatic oratorio about something called the children's blizzard in folklore. It's technically it's the blizzard of 1888, which swept through the Great Plains and killed an awful lot of people. Nobody knows how many, because records were hard to keep back then. And, you know, a lot of it, a lot of these people were living on the frontier. And it was particularly fierce in Nebraska. It's called the Children's Blizzard because it happened on one day, I believe it was January 12th, 1888. It was a warm day, and it struck suddenly. It's one of these perfect storm, now it's called a bomb cyclone or something, but this is like a super bomb. I mean, this happens once every, you know, 10,000 years or something. It blew up suddenly, and people described it as a locomotive just coming out of the sky and just wiping out everything in its place. It was a blizzard that lasted about, 10 hours, 12 hours. Unfortunately, I mean, part of the tragedy of this is that a lot of children happened to be walking home after school and not dressed warmly because it was a warm day, and a lot of them were simply frozen to death in their tracks. You know, so it's one of these events that's burned into the culture of Nebraska, you know, and the Great Plains generally is one of the. In any event. I was commissioned to write a piece about this, and I used a book called The Blizzard Voices, which is basically the reminiscences of the survivors. Ted Kooser, the great poet, and at one time the poet laureate of the United States, as well as the poet laureate of Nebraska, he put together this series of reminiscences of eyewitness survivors. And so it's, and then wrote his own poems around it. So it's, but what I like about it is that it's the voices of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, singing about their courage and the tragedy and the sacrifice. And so that's what this piece is. So I believe this is, you're going to play the third movement, which is The Blizzard Bore Down. This is where the blizzard actually hit. So what I did is I'm using the orchestra to capture and try to convey the terror and the horror of this sudden blizzard. And then also the response of the pioneers to this tragedy and describing what they did that day, what happened. And at the end, I have them all crying out for help using biblical language from a psalm, but all in their own languages. So one needs to remember that a lot of these people didn't even speak English yet. They were such recent immigrants. So, you know, it's Czech, it's Norwegian, it's Swedish, it's German. And for the Catholics, it's Latin, you know, so, and it's also in English. So anyways, that's what this movement is.
This is The Blizzard Bore Down from Blizzard Voices, composed by Paul Moravec, performed by the NEC Concert Choir, the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, conducted by Gil Rose. The soloists are Emily Pulley, soprano, Deborah Sillig, soprano, Erica Brookheiser, mezzo-soprano, Matthew DiBattista, tenor, David Kravitz, baritone, and David Cushing, bass baritone.
That was The Blizzard Bore Down from Blizzard Voices by Paul Moravec. Paul, I just have a question for you about music as a documentary art form. You know, you seem to like to work in the form of oratorio. How do those two things go together?
Well, this is the first of a series of works, The Blizzard Voices, that is, that I call American historical oratorios. And I've written now two others, and I'm working on a fourth one now. I mean, so this is a whole series of taking events and ideas and actual historical characters, using their words, building off of them, and musicalizing them, imagining them in musical terms. The Blizzard Voices started out as an opera commission from Opera Omaha. It's an opera company, they wanted an opera. And so I looked at the project, I looked at the text, and I saw this as not a staged drama with characters interacting as they do in a sophisticated modern opera, but as it really seemed to fit into the oratorio mold, even though it's not specifically a religious text and so on, which is what we usually associate with oratorios. By the way, you know, Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex is he called it an opera oratorio. It's a dramatic oratorio. So, and where the chorus is prominent, it's a very important aspect of it. What struck me about The Blizzard Voices is that it felt to me like Noah's flood, like a biblical Old Testament catastrophe. And I imagined that the characters interpreted in their own experience, and explicitly so, they did do this. They interpreted it in almost those terms, in biblical religious terms. And so it has. So actually, I begin this oratorio with the Book of Job. It's an excerpt from it. And then I go into the historical narrative and the actual words of the people, you know, involved in this, who survived. And the second in that series is an oratorio about the Underground Railroad called Sanctuary mm-hmm. Road, which also strikes me as having biblical overtones and biblical resonances and so on. The third in this series is about Ellis Island, and it takes place on a particular day in 1921. The premiere is supposed to happen at Carnegie Hall in 2020. The pandemic has postponed it. It will be this fall in November with the Oratorio Society of New York, for whom I also wrote Sanctuary Road, both of these with the librettist with whom I wrote The Shining, and that is Mark Campbell. And we're now working on the next of these American historical oratorios. It's called All Shall Rise, and it's about the history of voting rights in America, of all things.
Wow. Amazing. I mean, it's just amazing that you can take this text, and it makes sense when you put it in the terms of you're choosing these epic events and these epic issues,
right?
That really they kind of have a biblical proportion to them.
Good. That's a good way of putting scale. It. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of Sanctuary Road, I reached out to you because Sanctuary Road will be having a world premiere of the fully staged operatic version of the oratorio here in North Carolina, in Raleigh. Mm-hmm. North Carolina Opera is premiering that on March 6th. Yep. And I'm going to be there. I'm very excited. So I know I'm taking a whole group of people with me. So we'd like to listen to a piece from this opera called Rain. And this oratorio, it started out as an oratorio, is based on the writings of William Still. Can you tell us a little bit about William Still, you know, who he was, why he wrote down these narratives, and how did you come across them? How did you come to write this piece?
William Still is one of the most remarkable figures in American history that many people don't even know about. for example, there are wonderful full-length biographies of Frederick Douglass and others. And until very recently, there was not a full-length biography of William Still. It just came out last year, actually, by the way.
Wow.
So the wait is over. you can read all about William Still.
Add it to my book club list.
Exactly. He, in his own time, he was known as the father of the Underground Railroad. And he was based in Philadelphia. His activities in the railroad basically extended from the late 40s up to the Civil War and through the Civil War, but basically in those years, most active in the 1850s. And he was based in Philadelphia. He was born a free man. So he was a black man who was born a free man. So he had the advantage of an education and the freedom to have his own office. And he got involved in the Underground Railroad in the late 40s. This is all explained in the oratorio and the opera. And he facilitated the escape of something like, you know, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 fugitive slaves who came through his office. He helped them then proceed to the next stage of their journey because of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. It wasn't enough just to escape to the north, like a place like Philadelphia. One had then to go to Canada if you really wanted to be safe because of this act. So, anyways, he facilitated these escapes. He helped these fugitive slaves, and remarkably, he interviewed them all. And as a kind of Boswell to them, he wrote down everything they told him and kept these voluminous records, which he then published after the Civil War. I believe it was 1872, as a very big tome called The Underground Railroad, simply called The Underground Railroad. It's now referred to as The Underground Railroad Records to differentiate it from the actually phenomenon itself.
Mm-hmm. So this piece, Rain, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in this piece before we listen to it?
This is near the end of the opera, and this character is a fugitive slave. And this is, by the way, this is basically Mark Campbell. He wrote the libretto here. This is basically his aria, his imagining of a situation. It's based on real life, but he's taken a lot of poetic license here. And it's a beautiful text. It's a beautiful aria where she is trying to get across a town square. And she doesn't want to be seen. And the rain starts to come down. And she says, I want it to come down hard. I want it to come down Noah's Ark heavy, so that no one will see me, and I will. You hear how it turns out at the end. The ensemble then joins her at the end. So it's a kind of hymn to freedom in a way.
That's wonderful. So this is Rain from Sanctuary Road. This was premiered at Carnegie Hall in 2018 and was released on CD this past spring by Naxos. You'll be hearing on this recording Laquita Mitchell, Rehan Bryce Davis, Joshua Blue, Malcolm J. Merriweather, with the Oratorio Society of New York Choir, conducted by Kent Tridle.
you know, one aspect of this is that this is a new orchestration. So I'm going to be on hand to work with Bill Curry, the maestro, and, you know, principally my role is as the music man. So I'll be sorting out whatever details musically come up.
Yeah. So how did you just, you know, transition this from an oratorio? You said it's a new orchestration. Is that because it's going from an oratorio to an opera?
Yeah.
You had to make some adjustments?
Sure. I mean, the original version and the original production in Carnegie Hall is big. It's big forces. It's a chorus of about 150 people. It's still the same five soloists and a pretty big orchestra, you know, very full orchestra. So for North Carolina opera, partly because of the size of the pit and so on, I've scaled down the orchestra so that it still gives the same dramatic impression, but with, you know, fewer instruments. And also it'll be a smaller chorus. And because it's now an opera fully staged and so on, we need to keep those practical issues in mind as well. So there are a number of adjustments. We've also added a scene and we've added segues, and it's a longer piece now. And it's already operatic to begin with in a lot of ways. So it's not much of a transition in going to a fully staged version, a fully staged opera.
Well, can't wait to hear it and see it.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
It's going to be awesome.
This is new for me too.
So, you know, you write a lot for The Voice. We're going to talk about The Shining here in just a moment, your other opera. But one thing that Anna and I were noticing, that you write for a lot of big, strong voices. And yeah. So I had a question about that. You know, how do you decide what kind of voice that you want to write for? And is there a particular voice that appeals to you more than another?
Well, I mean, I like good singers of any kind. No, I mean, I write for whatever voice type is that the text and the context deals calls for. Mm-hmm. Basically, I've been very fortunate to work with some very great singers. My first opera I wrote for Patricia Rosette, the great soprano, they premiered in 2009. For Santa Fe Opera. So we cast her ahead of time. She graciously agreed to do this piece ahead of time. And boy, is that a great thing to write for a particular singer, a great singer, great actress as well, before you even begin to work. And an advantage of that is, for example, I asked her, what are your best notes? You know, mm-hmm. What do you really like to sing, and what can you describe some sort of techniques and even, you know, passages that you like to sing? So she sent me a list of things that, and so I use them. And the reason I do this is because if she sounds good, then I sound good, and we both win. You know, everybody mm-hmm. wins. So why not? So it's a great thing to be able to cast ahead of time and know who you're writing for. I wrote The Shining with Brian Mulligan in mind as Jack Torrance. And again, I went through the same process with him. I said, what are your best notes? What do you like to do? And so I incorporated all that into the Shining and into his character of Jack Torrance.
Nice. Well, since you bring up The Shining, and I had mentioned it just a moment ago, yeah. Let's go ahead and talk about it. So I have two questions for you right off the bat about it. I happen to be a Stephen King fan.
You are.
And I've read many of his books. But what was it about The Shining that you thought would make a good opera? And after Dr. Sleep was released, will there be a sequel opera as well?
Well, no, we're not going to do a sequel to this. So take that off the table. First of all, it's a great story. Stephen King is a very great storyteller. And part of the power of his work is that he deals with archetypes. That's what he gets deep into your psyche. And by telling stories that go back, you know, millennia to the beginning, you know, for example, the story of Abraham and Isaac I see that in The Shining. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is another story that, you know, that resonates there. And it's a story about, I think of opera as having basically three elements at least: love, death, and power. And The Shining in the novel has all of those aspects on steroids. I mean, it's super operatic. I need to mention that we've adapted the novel, and we need to make a distinction between the novel and the famous Kubrick version, which is brilliant, and I admire this film, but it's not what he wrote. And there are material substantive differences between the two versions, as Stephen King fans will know. And the story at its heart is really very warm, as opposed to the Kubrick version, which is icy and cold and cynical. And, you know, but the story is really about love, and it's about a story. It's a story of a family trying to stay together and survive under the most extraordinary pressures. And there's a lot to sing about. A big question in opera is, why are people singing? And this story answers that question from the get-go, because it's about very powerful emotions, very, very powerful, dramatic situations, even dilemmas that are basically unresolvable. This is all the stuff of drama. And a big question when you're writing for opera is, I think of it in terms of a tea kettle and filling it with water, putting it on the stove. What is it that causes the water to boil and then cause the tea kettle to sing, so to speak, mm-hmm. you know, to go, whoosh, mm-hmm. you know, that's what you need in an opera. Otherwise, it's not going to quite work, because it's essentially it's an irrational art form. Let's face it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's part of its power, you know. So you need strong emotion. You need very dramatic situations to even to justify the whole art form.
Yeah. How do you take something like a novel and boil it down to an opera? How do you boil it down from that very explicit, you know, language to the irrational musical form?
Well, that's the genius of Mark Campbell, the librettist, and he did a wonderful job. He knows how to do this. He took what is it, 650 pages? It's a long book, and he has to boil it down to about 50 pages of text, and he did it. You know, he condenses it down to its essence and makes it operatic and makes it very, very dramatic. And I think it works, you know.
Well, we're going to go ahead and listen to this now. This is The Shining. And from The Shining, we're listening to a piece called Lullaby. Where in the opera does this particular moment fall?
This is about a third of the way into act. It's in two acts. This is about a third of the way into act one. And the Torrances are alone in the hotel. They've been there for a while, for a couple of months. And they're in their apartment part of the Overlook Hotel. And this is where Danny has his, you know, sort of epileptic episode in the bathroom, and they freak out for good reason. They're trying to calm him down, and Wendy sings a lullaby to him. And while she's singing to him, Jack has this kind of soliloquy sidebar where he's standing to the side, and he has a memory of being abused by his father, who's named Mark Torrance, who is a character in the opera as a ghost. And so while Wendy is singing to Danny, it's interrupted in, Wendy can't hear it, Danny can't hear it, but it, in Jack's mind, it's interrupted by the appearance of his father, Mark Torrance, who's brought his cane with him to beat him at bedtime. So it's this twisted lullaby from his father going on during the actual lullaby. So it's a trio, actually.
We're going to go ahead and listen now to Lullaby from the opera The Shining, based on the 1977 novel by Stephen King. This is performed by the Minnesota Opera, Michael Christie conducting the Minnesota Opera Orchestra. Performers are Brian Mulligan, Kelly Caduce, and Mark Walters. I don't know if you've read 1122-63 by Stephen King.
I know about it.
It's an outstanding novel. Yeah. And he does something in that that he does in The Shining. In 1122-63, he treats the past like one of the characters. And he keeps saying right. The past is obdurate. In The Shining, he treats the hotel like another character. The hotel is evil, right? Sucking their souls. It's trapping everyone. And I was, you know, obviously I haven't listened to the whole opera, but I was just curious if when you were writing the opera, did you give any of character to the hotel?
Absolutely. Yeah. It even has its own leitmotifs and so on.
Cool. That's so cool. Oh, we need to talk about this off the air or off the show. That is awesome.
I think that's also an interesting thing to talk about on the show.
That too.
Actually, you might mention that it's the Minnesota production. Will be at Colorado Opera on next week.
You know,
or the week after, February 26th, that Colorado Opera is doing The Shining.
Great.
And it's basically the same sets, and you know.
Okay.
I hope it comes to Raleigh.
Well,
that'd be awesome.
We'll have to make a plug for Raleigh.
That's really cool. I love all the music that we've listened to today. It's been incredible getting to know your music and learning more about you as well, and taking the time to prepare for this week. And we really enjoyed it, both Anna and I. And Got to thank you so much for being on here today and making the time for the Composer Studio.
Well, it's my pleasure, my honor. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks. You have been listening to the music of composer Paul Moravec on the Composer Studio. If you enjoyed Paul's music, you can find out more about him at www.paulmoravec.com. That's PaulMoravec.com.
We want to hear from you. Have you discovered new music that moves you? Share it with us. Are you a composer who would like to be featured on the show? Contact us via our website at www.composersstudio.net or find us on Instagram or Facebook.
A special thanks goes out to our patrons for making Composer Studio possible. If you want to become a patron, just click the Become a Patron button on our website or look for us on Patreon.
Before we go, we leave you with a little something from Shakespeare's Tempest. But this rough magic I here abjure, and when I have required some heavenly music, which even now I do, to work mine end upon their senses, that this airy charm is for, I'll break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound, I'll drown my book. Prospero. Thank you so much for listening.